the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia. That is a reality. Boycott of the oligarchy, boycott of the large landowners, boycott of the imperialists. Today, in the peace process that is between the National Liberation Army and President Petro, the extreme right is not only ignoring it, but also placing emphasis on minor issues and at the same time manipulating public opinion in an evil way to let this process fail. Ultimately, it's the Colombian people who will decide the form of struggle and their destiny. And if today the peace process must be carried forward, we must respect it and respect it. I'm Eduardo Artes, and this is Black and White.
Estamos hoy día con Mauricio Leandro Osorio.
Today I talk to Mauricio Leandro Osorio. He is a Cuban-Chilean writer and journalist. He is the winner of some national and municipal awards in our country. He's also a political advisor in Colombia during the 2016 peace process with the FARC. You're very welcome to Black and White.
Bienvenido a Negro y Blanco por Hispan TV, Mauricio.
Thank you very much for the invitation, Eduardo.
Mauricio.
We're in the process of negotiations between the Colombian government and the National Liberation Army. What are these negotiations about? How do the antecedents influence the previous negotiations or the previous peace agreements with the FARC made in 2016 and 2017?
Realizada 2016-2017.
In the first place, we must remember that in the last 30 years, there have been seven Colombian governments that tried to establish these dialogues with the National Liberation Army. This time, Gustavo Petro, on August 3, 2023, announced that two important things were going to take place: ceasefire and installation of the National Participation Committee, which is an advance in relations to what was the agreement with the FARC. We remember that the FARC sat down to negotiate with the Colombian government, which was between the guerrilla and the government. This time, we will also witness participation of Colombians in this peace process. Another important thing that will happen is the presence of the National Liberation Army's chief negotiators in Bogota. It had never happened in history. Both parts have always participated in negotiations in another city. Well, these are the historical milestones. It is also important to observe some historical background to understand what the difference is in this new round of dialogues. There are also three important events in the history that the government tried to have dialogues with the National Liberation Army. The first round of negotiations was held in the 90s through Simon Bolivar Guerrilla Coordinating Board, where FARC and Popular Liberation Army were present. This negotiation failed due to the bad political will of the government of Cesar Gaviria, because the government carried out bombings and FARC camps at Casa Verde. It happened on the same day that the Constituent Assembly was installed, so that the negotiations were doomed to failure. The second round of negotiations took place during the presidency of Álvaro Uribe Vélez, between 2005 and 2007. Uribe had an aggressive strategy toward the insurgent forces called Democratic Security Policy. More than 6,400 cases of false positives are documented from that period of time. It was a government that carried out imperialist interventions in Colombia with military base installations and the implementation of Plan Colombia. His strategies could only intensify the internal Colombia war. The third round of negotiations with Colombian guerrillas took place during Juan Manuel Santos' presidency. It is important to emphasize the difference between previous negotiations with Colombian guerrillas and the one that is being carried out during Gustavo Petro's era. The government of Juan Manuel Santos and previous ones always saw the National Liberation Army as a very small group, and they didn't consider the political character of this guerrilla. In addition, they saw the National Liberation Army as a simple guerrilla that did not have a control unit, but rather functioned more or less federatively. So what happened later? When previous Colombian governments underestimated the National Liberation Army and didn't consider its military and political aspects, the National Liberation Army started to demonstrate its United National Control Unit by an armed strike. They carried out armed strikes and signed ceasefires at the national level. I believe that everything has changed right now. Gustavo Petro understands that he has to give political recognition to a guerrilla that has been fighting for 70 years and that was born as a political vision with great figures in its ranks. Its members are deeply concerned with the term liberation, like priest Camilo Torres and Manuel Perez Martinez in the 90s. So the political recognition of the National Liberation Army is a significant advance. The mistake that can occur in this new round of dialogues is to fall back into the same trap and not give political guarantees to the National Liberation Army and take it as a criminal band or a parliamentary group.
The term force is predominant at the negotiating table. The truth is that after the peace negotiations and reaching agreements with the FARC, the National Liberation Army doubled its violent activities. It was no longer considered simply as a minor guerrilla group.
Simplemente como un grupo guerrillero menor.
That's right. We shall realize this background to understand the new phase of negotiations. The Colombian government and the FARC signed a revised peace deal in 2016. It is important to see what happened in that moment. In that time, FARC abandoned arms in the areas under their control. They were governing in those areas because the Colombian state had abandoned them. The Colombian government forgot about the health service, security guarantees, police, and medical services and making roads in those zones. It was the FARC that carried out all these missions in these abandoned areas. So we witnessed the emergence of parliamentary groups and National Liberation Army as well. This current dialogue occurs at a time of escalation. We are well aware that there is progress in political participation of the FARC, with their political party known as Comunes. Five of the FARC members were in the Senate, and another five were in the Chamber of Deputies. 1,300 social leaders have been murdered so far since the signing of the peace agreement in Colombia. Among them, we can see 330 signatories of the peace agreement.
That is exactly right. The U.S. permanently boycotted the peace agreements. It is important to mention that to this day, Simon Trinidad, who is one of the main leaders of the FARC, is imprisoned in the United States, which makes the situation even more complicated. His absence made the peace process more difficult. The U.S. could easily release him as a political prisoner. Well, these events, assassinations of social leaders and Simon Trinidad's imprisonment, have a clear message and means that they need to enter a new phase. Well, let's have a break and then we will continue our program.
Entrar, digamos, en otro momento. Bueno, vamos a una pausa y continuamos.
We continue our program on Black and White with Mauricio Leandro Osorio. We were talking about an important issue. What do you think about these events related to the FARC? What do you think about today's FARC? I need your opinion to continue our talk regarding the peace negotiations. Your opinion will be useful for Gustavo Petro and the National Liberation Army as well.
Tanto Petro como los helenos.
I believe that there should be certain guarantees for the governments, and they must be implemented correctly. We've been witnessing progressive governments in the recent years. Uribismo has actually boycotted the peace dialogues in the recent years. Many FARC fighters were granted amnesty, and were bringing the process of integration into civil society were actually murdered in that time. Their security guarantees were not fulfilled. Many social leaders were also murdered. Right now, there is progress in the peace dialogues. We see the political participation of the FARC as communist party. There's also a significant point here. There's also advance in the process of justice regarding the reconstruction of what really took place during the armed conflict in Colombia. Unfortunately, the right-wing policy of these pro-imperialist governments was to arrest the parliamentary leaders and extradite them to the United States. These right-wing governments also extradited guerrilla leaders to the U.S., such as Simon Trinidad. These actors should have contributed to the peace and provided reparation to the victims through participation in the special jurisdiction for peace.
Do you think that it is possible to do justice to Simon Trinidad and release him to come back to Colombia and act as a guarantor of peace? It is a demand of all left-wing democratic forces in Colombia and Latin America as well.
It would be a significant step, but I have to reiterate that this depends on the political will of the government. If there's a progressive government in power, we could move towards these guarantees of security and dialogue until he's freed. They basically expect his freedom. We shall observe the advancement of this dialogue. There's a real impediment in order to reach total peace in Colombia. Colombia's president has a plan for total peace. The role of monitoring and verification organizations is crucial to carry out a ceasefire at a time of escalation of the conflict. We shall realize that there are the National Liberation Army, parliamentary groups, and FARC guerrilla dissidents in Colombia. These dissidents are in conflict over territories abandoned after the agreement. Over 52 massacres took place during 2023 as a result of this conflict in Colombia. So we can't pretend that nothing has happened. We see the renewed outbreak of war. There must be a real ceasefire between the government and the National Liberation Army. But how shall we reassure that the National Liberation Army and other parliamentary groups do not enter into this conflict? It is a really complicated task, but we have to keep trying to reach peace.
That's right. The form of struggle obeys a special historical moment for specific needs. I believe that the entire history of Colombia has been ruled by dictators. Colombia hasn't enjoyed democratic moments so much. That's why there are the FARC, the National Liberation Army, the Popular Liberation Army, and the 19th of April movement. Gustavo Petro was also a member of the 19th of April movement in that certain period of time. The armed conflict in Colombia is transversal, from socio-democratic organizations such as the 19th of April movement to others that claim to be communists. It is a constant conflict. The armed conflict was actually the only way to make policies. The armed conflict in Colombia, Latin America, and the world has an expiry date. What do you think? I have my opinion, but I am not going to mention it right now.
I think that first we must know about Colombia. Colombia continues to be one of the bastions of the U.S. imperialism in Latin America, along with Chile. There are 7 U.S. military bases in Colombia. Colombia is a strategic ally of the NATO. The Colombian state doesn't guarantee the security, education, healthcare, and other services in different Colombian territories, and that's why there's a continuous war. Drug trafficking is a key element in Colombian internal conflict. Drug trafficking also causes various problems. Many Popular Liberation Army soldiers are connected to drug trafficking. Many people in Colombia have told me, I didn't turn into a guerrilla fighter because I used to read Marx. I turned into a guerrilla fighter because the Colombian army and parliamentary soldiers assassinated my family members. So I joined the guerrilla groups to stay alive. I wanted to take revenge from my family. There was a guerrilla fighter that told me, if the parliamentary groups find me, I will join them. If the FARC find me, I will join them as well. And I hope that the FARC will find me. I mean that they didn't have a profound political and ideological background to join these groups. They only wanted to ensure their lives. Many of these guerrilla fighters used to tell me, I'm going to sign a paper to ensure my life in the coming years. 330 guerrilla fighters signed these papers and were finally assassinated.
The power in the hands of landowners is one of the many obstacles to reach peace in Colombia. How have they used their power with bloodshed and fire? They have treated the peasants as slaves. They've also overexploited the resources of peasants. As a professional journalist, what do you think about the role of these sectors in Colombia?
This sector of Colombian society is among the actors that has intensified the internal conflict. We shall include them in the citizen participation, just like the FARC. This is the only way to control such actor in the internal conflict. So, participation committee in facilitating the inclusive participation of Colombian society in the peace process is very important. This committee has the responsibility to invite the relatives of the assassinated peasants in the negotiation and guarantee the lives of guerrilla fighters and peasants' families in rural areas as well.
There is a really complex situation in Latin America. The U.S. is now the first world power. It is actually becoming stronger every day. Can the U.S. become an impediment to the peace process negotiations in Colombia? We should consider this point that the U.S. thinks that Latin America is its backyard. Latin America may be the last bastion of the U.S. because it has lost Africa and Asia. There are other conflicts in the world as well. How could the U.S. impact the peace negotiations in Colombia?
I have my personal opinion. I believe that there is no peace in Colombia because we are very close to the U.S. The U.S. has also intensified the Colombian internal conflict. They didn't need to carry out coups or Operation Condor. We have seen the U.S. human rights violations and interventions in almost all Colombian governments. I think that Gustavo Petro's government is an exception in this case. Now the power was divided between liberals and conservatives in Colombia. In the last decade, we also witnessed Uribismo. We should also remember that Juan Manuel Santos, who signed the peace deal, used to be Uribe's defense minister during the Democratic Security government at the height of the war. It is a very complex issue. That's why I'm insisting in a point that the right wing must not come to power so we can guarantee the peace in Colombia. The U.S.'s interventionism must also be stopped. If we can't stop it, we can't reach peace in Colombia.
I agree with you. Colombia must stop U.S. interventionism. I think that Gustavo Petro has authorized the presence of NATO in some areas in order to protect the environment. This is one of the contradictions. I think that the participation of ex-FARC members in the negotiations can guarantee their lives. This is very complex. We believe in the intelligence and capacity of Colombian people. Mauricio, we are about to finish our program, and I need your opinion about these negotiations between the Colombian government and the National Liberation Army. Can we see such negotiations with other guerrilla groups and bring peace to Colombia? If it doesn't happen, these little organizations will become stronger. The same thing happened when the Colombian government and the FARC signed the peace treaty, and the National Liberation Army emerged on the other side.
Con la FARC.
Bueno, yo creo que para eso es importante, en primer lugar,
I've already mentioned this point. I think that it was a very good step that the Colombian government recognized these groups as political organizations. The National Liberation Army has been recognized as a political and military organization. They aren't known as only a military organization anymore. It is important not to use the word demobilization because they're not going to release troops from active service. They may lay down their weapons. The important point is that they will stay in their places but will leave their weapons. The forms of struggles will be changed. The key point is to recognize them. It has been 70 years that we face the internal conflict in Colombia.
De lucha en Colombia.
60 años. Sí, y entonces la lucha armada
70 years of war. The internal armed conflict still exists.
Es que no sé, yo no sé si es un tema, no sé si la lucha armada alguna vez fue una moda. La arriba sí.
The internal armed conflict still exists. That's right. It will continue to exist if the Colombian government can't come up with a clear decision to guarantee their lives. Because the guerrilla members' families have been assassinated. The Colombian police and military aren't present in these areas. Means that no one guarantees their lives. The Colombian state with parliamentary forces and police are the ones that commit these crimes. Those who have lost their family members will take weapons in their hands and defend themselves.
Así es, Mauricio.
Mauricio, you are right. They had to use their weapons in conflict during all these years. It was the only way for them to be recognized as a political body for their sovereignty, justice, and independence. Thank you very much for accepting our invitation to be on Black and White. I hope to see you next time because I think that this peace process is in development. Thank you very much.
Está en desarrollo. Muchas gracias.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu Alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, we're welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Farahzad. Stay tuned. There are many examples about forgiving others. One good example was when I was visiting the holy tomb of Imam Ar-Ridha alayhi salam in Mashhad. A person came to me and said, "My wife cheated on me. Should I forgive her or disclose her secret affairs to her family and relatives for her betrayal?" My answer was, "Forgiveness, because I have heard that if a person who is harmed bodily or emotionally by someone forgives others, Allah will compensate for them on the Day of Judgment."
ولی راهکار اصلی که خدا دوست داره چیه آخه؟
Of course, the best solution of Allah in such situations is forgiveness. Allah tells us to forgive others exactly like the way He forgives us. Even if we miss our close relatives or family members in an accident, we can forgive the guilty person. We must take refuge in Allah from the hardships and afflictions, and we must forgive the faults of others so that we are forgiven by others and Allah. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Farhasad. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. In Britain, data obtained under the Freedom of Information Act by the charity Fair Trials shows that at least 150 prisoners, all of them male, have spent at least 5 years or more waiting to face a jury in the United Kingdom. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Independent has covered this story and tells us more. Prisoners in the United Kingdom are being forced to wait 5 years behind bars before trial as the number on remand soars to a record high, fueled by a growing court backlog. According to Ministry of Justice figures, some 15,523 people were languishing in overcrowded jails without having been convicted as of 30th of June. A 50-year high and up 16% compared to the previous year. Data obtained under Freedom of Information laws by the charity Fair Trials shows at least 150 people, all of them male, had spent 5 years waiting to face a jury as of 31st of December, with black men making up 33% of those facing the longest waits. Close to 2,000 prisoners on remand had been held for over a year. Another nearly 2,500 people were locked up for over 6 months, after which time a judge must approve an extension. A top lawyer warned that some defendants were pleading guilty to crimes despite insisting they were innocent because they would be released from prison sooner. As the Crown Court's cases backlog also reached a new record high, having doubled in 4 years. It is the latest shocking indictment on the state of Britain's justice system as prisoners come under the spotlight following the escape of terror suspect Daniel Khalifa from Her Majesty's Prison Wandsworth recently, amid wider concern over chronic overcrowding and understaffing. Jack Straw, Labour Home Secretary between 1997 and 2001, said it was preposterous and just extraordinary to leave people languishing so long in prison without a trial, charging the Conservative government with presiding over the most serious crisis in the criminal justice system that I can remember. Tory MP Robert Buckland, who served as Justice Secretary for 2 years until September of 2021, called for the cases to be examined and clearly explained, warning that people should not be on remand for years without a proper reason. A Ministry of Justice spokesperson claimed cases involving the longest waits mainly involved complex fraud or were trials with a large number of defendants that ordinarily take a long time to prosecute. Lambasting the years-long remand wait as totally and completely unacceptable, Blair-era Justice Secretary Lord Falconer said the government needs an emergency plan because we can't let these long delays continue. Lord Falconer called for the greater use of tagging for non-violent suspects and temporary Nightingale courts, while Jack Straw said ministers could do a great deal more to bring more courts into operation, including using retired and part-time judges. Rob Priest of the Howard League for Penal Reform said the overcrowding crisis is most acute in jails housing prisoners awaiting trial. He likened lengthy, Kafkaesque remand times to indefinite prison sentences, which were abolished in 2012 and criticised recently by the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Torture. Official figures show as of June, more than a fifth of those held on remand were accused of drug offences. According to most recent data, just 32% awaiting trial were remanded for allegedly violent crimes. Ian Aitchison, a former security chief at His Majesty's Prison at Wandsworth, said the under-pressure Category B London jail was just one of those struggling to cope with the added pressure of growing backlog of remand cases. Ian Aitchison said locking up non-violent suspects for 5 years is an unacceptable use of state power. He warned that those on remand are often at far greater risk of self-harm because of their uncertain status. Conservative Justice Committee Chairman Sir Bob Neill warned that the churn of record numbers of remand inmates was putting further strain on prison officers. Sir Bob Neill said it can only increase the risk of violence when innocent people are locked up in prison without family visits or rehabilitation schemes, often in some of the worst conditions. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story and tells us more. The worrying situation has led to a mental health crisis, with levels of suicide and self-harm among remand prisoners in the United Kingdom skyrocketing as people become hopeless. Griff Ferris, Fair Trial's senior legal and policy officer, said remand inmates are often among those locked up in the cells for 23 hours a day in harrowing conditions, amounting to solitary confinement, forced to choose between calls to family and loved ones, exercise or showering, and denied access to education and other rehabilitative programs. Griff Ferris criticized the British government for actively contributing to the remand crisis by shredding infrastructure and legal aid, and said he believed Labour had avoided taking any meaningful action to challenge ministers over fears of being seen as soft on crime. claiming that the government simply cannot get to grips with its basic duties, Shadow Justice Secretary Shabana Mahmood insisted Labour would take immediate action to increase the number of Crown prosecutors at least half by half and build prison places, pledged but not delivered by the Conservatives. Dita Saliuka, whose brother, Liridan, 29 years old, died by suicide at His Majesty's prison at Belmarsh on 2nd of January 2020, weeks after his trial was pushed back 6 months, having already spent 5 months waiting, warned, "Our prisons are unsafe and unable to provide basic levels of care." Dita Saliuka warned that those who see their remand custody limits extended, like her brother, wait and wait and lose hope. Speaking of those eventually acquitted, she added, "You're in prison for years and then you get found not guilty. What happens after that? You might lose your family, your job, your house, your employment, your relationships. You don't get any of that back, and you don't get anything at all." Conversely, Law Society Deputy Vice President Richard Atkinson said, "There are certainly cases where defendants will have spent longer on remand than their potential sentence, with some opting to plead guilty to get out sooner, despite lawyers advising otherwise."
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, in which we try to ask and answer some of the questions related to the Islamic laws based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before we embark on our episode, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, That's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching Makassas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Tawheed, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws of prayer based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Well, Sheikh Tawheed, a follower has not been present during any of the two sermons offered in the Friday prayer. And during the prayer, this person, when the imam has started, will his prayer or her prayer be valid and discharge him of his obligation?
That's a good question. Of course, it is sufficient, and the person who joins the prayer is not supposed to repeat the prayer. The two rakahs of the prayer are sufficient for the dhuhr prayer. And of course, it is said by the religious authorities that if a person is present while the prayer leader is giving his sermon, it is necessary that he listen to him and not engage in a conversation with someone on his sides, okay? So he should listen, he should try to understand what the imam says. But okay, if he fails to reach or the khutbah, the sermon, and he can catch up with the imam in his, the rak'ah of the prayer, there is no objection to him. The prayer will be sufficient, and he does not need to repeat the dhuhr.
Mm-hmm, I see. Well, when should the sermons be delivered, before or after the noon?
Well, it starts at the time of dhuhr, when the sun starts declining to the west. And it continues for a while, you know. It can continue for 30 minutes or maximum, 45 minutes. Because it should not be delayed so much, you know. And if it is delayed, then the issue is different, you know. Mm-hmm. The mu'mineen, the believers, will be required to perform the zuhr prayer. The prayer leader should try to divide his khutbah into two. During the two khutbahs, he can speak about anything, but he should enjoin the people to do good. He should invite them to perform the ma'roof, the good things, and, you know, to maintain piety, to fear Allah, you know. These are the things which he need to highlight, to explain to people, to call upon the believers,
yes,
to adhere to religious values, to taqwa, and so on and so forth. And his khutbah should not be too long, so long that it will
tire everyone.
Yeah, it will go on for 1 hour and 1 hour 30 minutes. Otherwise, if it goes on, then the time of the Friday prayer will pass.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, of course, the mu'minin will have to perform the dhuhr prayer.
I see. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Sawid. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Sawid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws of prayer based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Well, Sheikh Sawid, what's the appropriate time for Friday prayers?
Well, as I said, the Friday prayers should be performed in the earliest portion of the time, in the time which is prescribed. And the religious sources, and the best time is to perform it. You know, the khutbah, as I said, can be short, and the khutbah should not be very long. And of course, the khutbah can consist of 5 or 6 sentences. You know. The first khutbah and the second khutbah, that's a kind of khutbah, because it's not necessary for the khutbah to be very, very long, okay? Mm-hmm. Some speakers are very much interested in giving a long khutbah to kind of impress the people, you know, but that's not necessary. You know, the khutbah can be short, but it can be useful and impressive. And of course, the Friday prayer should be performed in the earliest portion of the time. You know, if there is 30 minutes, you know, after the midday, this okay, there's no problem. If it's 45 minutes, that's okay. Again, still, it is sufficient for the Zuhr. But if it goes beyond the, you know, if it becomes 1 hour or more than 1 hour, if it, you know, it goes on, then the religious authorities have said that, you know, the mu'minin should perform the Dhuhr prayer as well.
Mm-hmm, I see. Can a person, Sheikh Sawid, offer Friday prayers at his home with his wife, for example, standing behind him?
Well, we should differentiate between a congregational prayer and a Friday prayer. The Friday prayer is also a kind of congregational prayer, but it is called Friday prayer. And the Friday prayer should be held in the presence of 5 people, at least.
At least 5 people,
including the Friday prayer leader himself. Now, there are certain other conditions which must be fulfilled. And that is, of course, there should not be any other Friday prayer held in the vicinity. Otherwise, it cannot be performed. Now, if a man stands and there are 5 people and there's no other Friday prayer held around in the neighborhood, that's right. Okay. He can perform it. The Friday prayer leader should give 2 sermons and then he should perform the prayer itself. Now, if a man wants to perform the Friday prayer at home with his wife standing behind him, that's not sufficient. That's not enough. And of course, but congregational prayer or jama'at prayer, that's okay. It's very good. If, for example, the husband meets the necessary conditions and he is qualified as a prayer leader, he stands and his children, his wife, you know, his, you know, children, kids stand behind him. That's very good. Mm. You know, it is such a good thing if the prayer leader, for example, the man of the family, he is qualified as a prayer leader, and then he stands and with his family members stand behind him and perform the Friday, the jama'at prayer, the congregational prayer. It's such a good thing, I think.
Yes.
And there are many families I know. I've seen families with the man of the family standing in front and other children, other people stand behind him in the family.
Yes. And they offer the congregation.
The congregation. But I think other families should also follow suit. They right. should do the same.
But can they do the same thing to the Friday prayer?
No, as they the cannot. Friday prayer. No, they cannot do, you know. Mm-hmm. So Jama'a prayer, you know, there is a riwayah which says that if there is, for example, you know, for example, more than 10 people in a Jama'a prayer, then if all the trees become pens, and if all the malaik, the angels, become writers,
mm-hmm.
they be writing the fadila, the sawab of the prayer, they will not be able to write mm-hmm. the sawab
right.
of the prayer, of the congregational prayer.
I see. Another quick question near the end of the program, Sheikh Javid. Is it, you know, necessary to listen to the two sermons or both of the sermons offered before Friday prayers?
Well, as I did mention that when the khutbah is going on and the prayer leader is giving his sermon, his maw'izah or khutbah, of course, it is mandatory for everyone to listen carefully to him and not engage in a discussion with other people in the gathering, you know. Mm. Everyone should listen because the khutbah are supposed to work to function as a replacement for the for the two rakats mm-hmm. of the Zuhr prayer. So it is.
So does it make? I mean, does talking, for example, or engaging conversation with some people in the Friday prayer invalidate
no,
your Friday prayer?
It does not invalidate. Of course, it is. It is. It's not haram to speak. Okay, if you have something to, you are supposed to listen. You are listening, but at the same time you speak. But what is important is that one should not, you know, engage in a discussion which completely distracts his attention. Okay, so what is it is essential that the person attending Friday prayer listen to the person, to the speaker carefully. If he understands, maybe there are some, you know, there are some people who do not understand. Okay, they are not supposed to listen because listening will not be of any use to him. So okay. Listening is basically wajib.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Thank you, my dear listeners, for joining us on the program Islam Class on IRIB English Radio. From me and the rest of the crew, we say wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم مجا لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines this hour. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says the United States is definitely an accomplice in the Israeli regime's crimes against the Palestinians in Gaza. Palestinian officials in Gaza say Israel has dropped more than 12,000 tons of explosives on the besieged territory as the death toll from the regime's strikes tops 6,500. Also in the headlines, pro-Palestine rallies continue unabated across the globe, with protesters condemning Israel's brutal aggression against the Gaza Strip. This is news. Thanks for joining.